And here we go.
The FOMC raised its policy interest rate by 0.25 percentage point.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 16th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To the surprise of absolutely nobody, the Federal Reserve, the FOMC, technically the Federal Open Market Committee, raised interest rates today. As Chair Powell said in that cut, we just played a quarter of a percentage point, just as everybody had been guessing. It is not quite the taking away of the punch bowl of legend, which I'll explain in a minute. But still, the Fed is now officially trying to slow the economy down. Inflation specifically, of course, but along with that do come some risks.
In my view, the probability of a recession within the next year is not particularly elevated.
Well, good to know, Chair Powell, but...
And why do I say that?
Yeah, exactly.
Aggregate demand is currently strong, and most forecasters expect it to remain so.
Aggregate demand, that's us, consumers, consuming, but please, go on.
If you look at the labor market, also very strong, conditions are tight, and payroll job growth is continuing at very high levels.
All right, what else you got?
Household and business balance sheets are strong.
All of which is great, but as Powell went on to say, if inflation is blasting right along, ain't nothing else good gonna happen. Price stability is Fed speak for inflation that is under control.
Without price stability, you really can't have a sustained period of maximum employment. One of our most fundamental obligations is to maintain and restore, in this case, price stability.
For those who don't regularly watch Federal Reserve press conferences, about which I totally get it, there were a whole lot of questions today about us, about consumers, and what Powell would say to those consumers watching prices go up almost 8% annually right now.
I guess I'd start by just assuring everyone that we're fully committed to bringing inflation back down and also sustaining the economic expansion.
The question, of course, is how does he do that? So that is the first question I'm going to put to Neela Richardson. She's one of our Friday regulars, of course, also the chief economist at ADP. Hey, Neela.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so over to you. He's trying to thread the needle here. Let me just explain what I said earlier. William McChesney Martin in 1955, Fed chair, says his job is to take the punch bowl away just as the party is getting started. So how does Powell do that without slowing things down?
Well, as they say in the biz, Kai, he does it very carefully. And there are really three steps, and the steps are hinted at in his comments that you just played. One is about Federal Reserve credibility. He needs to convince everyone, all of us, consumers, businesses, investors, that the Fed is not only committed to inflation, but they're capable of bringing it down to more comfortable levels. So that's step one.
Yeah.
Step two is to start hiking interest rates. And this, the Fed has a long history. They know how to do this. They know how to raise and lower rates. They're going to start this hiking cycle. What they haven't been specific about is exactly how much they hike each meeting, mm-hmm. but the cycle has begun and they're comfortable in that process.
Okay.
The third thing they have to do, and this has never been done before, Kai, is unwind $9 trillion of right. government securities. That's never been done. They attempted it before, and it didn't work out so well. Key credit market dried up. So this is very tricky. That's the third component. If they can do all these three steps without slowing the economy, they should get every award the world has to offer.
Well, I don't know what awards Federal Reserves get. But anyway, all right, look, we should have given more than 3.5 minutes for this interview because I got so many questions. But look, just taking what you said in order. Number one, Fed credibility. There are those who will say, and increasingly so, Jay, where you been? Inflation's at 8% and it's been going up for a while. You're late.
Yeah, well, he's going to let everyone judge that. He said that okay. in the press conference. But yeah. what he would have said is, well, we expected these supply chain bottlenecks, which has been the culprit of inflation, yeah. Yeah. to actually ease. Well, they did start to ease, but then they got hit by a variant and then another variant and then a humanitarian crisis, which has another side effect, which is maybe creating some more supply bottlenecks and increases in commodity prices, namely oil and gas and food prices. And so that might tip inflation up higher here in the United States, and they still don't know just how high that inflation rate can go.
Okay. Number two, they're going to raise consistently, it seems. Chair Powell did say today that every meeting this year is live. That is to say, we could raise at each and every meeting. Does he now have to raise at every meeting now that he said every meeting is live? Or can he just say, oh, well, you know, we'll see?
It's going to be a meeting cliffhanger. So every meeting, all of us are going to say, how high are they going to raise rates? Are they going to raise rates? And what he'll say consistently is, we'll be led by the data. Yeah. We'll be led by this evolving economy. So he can't commit to the pace.
Fair enough. 10 seconds. Can he do it?
Of course. We're optimists. He can do it. It's going to be tricky to do so without notably sending the economy into recession. But there is a pathway to success, even if the growth rate is slower than we'd all like.
Neela Richardson, chief economist at ADP, also every now and then on a Friday with us. Neela, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kai.
Talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, traders did their usual. Jay Powell said, what? Oh, no, wait, it's okay. Freak out. We'll have the details. They really did. Every time Powell comes on, they do it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, Neela was talking about supply chains. So a word here about cargo, the guts of the global economy, getting stuff from point A to point B so that it can be bought and sold. Containerized shipping on boats, we talk about all the time. That's how most stuff gets to and from the United States and a bunch of other places. Air cargo, we talk about every now and then. That is more global. In Europe, rail is real popular. Catch is, though, along with Russian airspace being off limits, a lot of logisticians have stopped using the rail network that goes through Russia to get goods from China to Europe. Just 2% or so of the stuff on that route gets shipped by rail, but it is the high-margin stuff, the car parts and the computers and things like that. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is our cargo correspondent for today.
There have been a lot of disruptions in global shipping over the last couple years. There was the Great Boat Watch of 2021, when that container ship got stuck in the Suez Canal, and there was a surge in demand for goods in general, which clogged ports and sent shipping prices from China to Europe through the roof. Jan Fransoo is a professor of operations management at Tilburg University in the Netherlands.
So ocean freight, typically pre-COVID, maybe you paid $1,500.
That's per shipping container.
And then in this panic last year, this could go over 10,000 in some cases.
So companies wanted to become less dependent on waterways and find a cheaper alternative. And what's an alternative to sea? Land.
What we've actually seen is that the share of rail has really increased quite a bit.
Most of these rail routes go right through Russia, where train freight increased 40% last year. And as the price of shipping by sea has gone up, shipping by train has become more affordable. It's also fast. A journey from China to Europe that takes 40 days by ship may take as little as 15 by train. Of course, the war complicates all of this. Ian Cullingham is with AIT Worldwide Logistics, a transportation management company.
By choice, a lot of customers we've seen now move away from the rail. In fact, some have even said they don't want to move rail for the foreseen future.
Shipping by air isn't an ideal alternative. For starters, it's much more expensive. And because of the war, planes are taking longer routes to avoid Russian and Ukrainian airspace. This means planes can't turn around as fast and have to carry more fuel for their longer trips, which leaves them less space for cargo. So Cullingham says the prices are in constant flux.
We'd love to get back into that position where we can just at least go back to a customer and say, okay, we can get you a rate for 3 months. It's not going to change. But the way the market is currently, we just can't do that.
The strain created by the war is increasing demand for shipping through whatever land, air, and sea routes are left. And this will affect how much goods cost, not just in Europe. Willie Shi is a professor of management practice at Harvard.
We live in a connected world. So prices and costs in one part of the world, as they really rise dramatically, they affect everybody, whether we like it or not.
He says if shipping prices between Asia and Europe climb, cargo companies will also raise the cost of shipping to the U.S. Meanwhile, the manufacturers that make these goods, they're not only going to increase prices for European consumers, they'll spread the pain out evenly across the world. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Russia sanctions, we know about, been talking about them for 3 weeks. Kristen was just telling us about moving cargo by rail because of them. And honestly, when was the last time trains got any love in the economic discourse, right? Not yet fully explored, though, I would offer is China and what economic options the United States and its allies have if Beijing becomes more overt in its support of the Russian invasion. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has that one.
China has criticized Western sanctions and said it will trade with Russia as usual.
But on the other hand, China is really worried about the global condemnation reverberating back on itself.
Jennifer Lind is a professor of international relations at Dartmouth College.
The world is going to be very interested in how China responds.
If it comes to Russia's rescue, that would put China at odds with its largest trading partner. Arthur Dong is a professor at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
This is now a three-dimensional chess game, which certainly escalates the potential for downward spiral of economic repercussions.
Dong says the U.S. could expand tariffs on Chinese goods and the list of products that U.S. companies are banned from exporting to China.
Broadening the scope of export controls can be a very powerful deterrent.
And he says if China faces new sanctions from the U.S., it would become increasingly isolated.
They call this secondary sanctions, and that's where the real power of this tool resides.
But sanctions may not stop China from stepping in as an economic buffer, says Joshua Eisenman, a senior fellow in China studies for the American Foreign Policy Council. He says shoring up its partnership with Russia is a priority for China.
To the extent that we believe that through economic coercion, we can change their politics.
That's just not going to happen, he says. And something that might give the U.S. pause, tariffs on China tend to raise prices for American consumers. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think we all play scenario games in our conversations. What if, what if, what if?
Yeah, we do. First, though, let's do the numbers. Sad, happy again. Dow Industrial's up 518 today, 1.5%, 34,063. NASDAQ up 487, 3.7%, 13,436. S&P 500 gained 95 points, 2.2%, ended things at 43.57. Tonight begins the Jewish holiday of Purim, which is partly celebrated by eating a triangular baked good called a hamantash, or a hamantash perhaps. I don't know. You'll correct me, I'm sure. Anyway, more than 130 bakeries in the United States, Canada, and overseas have joined a fundraiser called Hamantashen for Ukraine, started after the invasion by a baker in Berlin. All proceeds go to charities in Poland dedicated to helping refugees, of which there are now, I think the United Nations says, 3.5 million people. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. So, it's done. Money is more expensive right now than it was this morning. But to be clear, because context matters, money is just a teensy, teensy little bit more expensive than it was this morning. But now what happens? Because it's not like today's interest rate increase has come as a surprise, right? Well, turns out the housing market has been bracing for what higher mortgage rates are going to mean for home affordability and therefore sales. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, the relationship between Fed policy and mortgage rates, it's not as straight ahead as one might imagine.
The Fed's move today targets the federal funds rate. That's the interest banks charge each other to lend money overnight. Doesn't get much more short-term than that. But mortgages are much longer-term loans, and their rates closely follow yields on the 10-year Treasury note.
There's no doubt that there is some relationship between these two.
That's Christopher Thornburg with Beacon Economics.
As the Federal Reserve tightens up on the short end, they make money less available. And in theory, rates should also be going up on the long end.
Now, the Fed has been telling us for months that they were going to do this, says economist Ben Keyes at the Wharton School.
And so I think most market observers would expect that this has already been baked into today's mortgage rates.
Mortgage rates are up about 1% since late last year. In its statement, the Fed also said it would start reducing its holdings of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities at a coming meeting, which could further push up rates. Nancy Vandenhouten, lead economist at Oxford Economics, says the market's been expecting that, too.
We do expect, you know, further increases in mortgage rates along with treasury rates. But that's based more on our outlook for inflation at this point.
Because when bond investors see higher inflation on the horizon, they want to be compensated for that in the form of higher interest rates. Again, Chris Thornburg.
There is a basic objective economic reality here, which is that bond rates in the long run have to be higher than inflation.
So whatever the Fed does, he expects the cost of borrowing to go up. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Also out today, although less glamorous, I guess you might say, than a Fed interest rate increase, was the report on February retail sales. Not great is a phrase that one might use. Up just 0.3% over January, not adjusted for inflation. You do adjust for inflation as prudence dictates, and retail sales were actually down. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains what this might be telling us.
For much of the last year, Mark Cohen at Columbia Business School says retail sales numbers have been a lot like a bouncing ball.
One month is great. Everybody's goofy and giddy about the prospects. And the next month is a big disappointment.
December was a disappointment. January, goofy and giddy. And February, another disappointment.
I think this is a manifestation of the ongoing remaining instability as we try to come out of COVID.
And not so much a sign, Cohen says, that people are changing their habits because of rising prices.
I think the inflation effect on retail sales is really yet to be seen.
People did spend less on certain things in February.
On things like furniture and some household goods.
Dana Peterson at the Conference Board says some of that was likely just people reining it in a little after buying a lot in January. And some of it was probably also that they were more eager to go out than shop after Omicron peaked.
We saw a real strength in people going to bars and restaurants.
That's one of the first things people stop doing when they're really worried about money and rising prices, says Ted Rossman at Bankrate.
A lot of people still have pent-up demand, increased savings. I think pent-up demand may end up winning over inflation.
In survey after survey, though, people are saying they're worried about inflation.
But what's so interesting is this kind of disconnect, because really ever since last summer, consumer confidence has been poor.
Yet so far, Rossman says, retail sales have held up a lot better than consumer confidence. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The world's top two exporters of wheat in the year 2020 were Russia and then us, and then Canada and France in the 3 and 4 spots. Ukraine was number 5. I told you that so I could tell you this. The Grains and Oilseeds Index, yes, first of all, there is such a thing. It's produced by the International Grains Council. Well, second of all, it's up 17% in the past 6 weeks. Food and how much it costs and how those costs come to be is obviously right in our sweet spot. So we got Eric Wilkie on the phone earlier today. He's the president of Arizona Grains Incorporated. They do grain wholesale. And I asked him exactly how grain buyers and sellers get to a price.
Yeah, I would say in the grain industries, it's concentrated mostly around the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and it's the futures markets. That is a proxy for price pretty much anywhere in the world for corn, soybeans, and wheat.
Right.
We all know our relationship on a normalized basis relative to that Chicago futures quote. But when there's this volatility, it becomes a little murky as to what your relationship is to Chicago. In other words, what is the freight rates from that market to this market, for instance, where I operate? What's the price of petroleum? What's the interest rates? All those things moving so quickly create the difficulty to find a market price at any particular location.
Boy, there was a lot in that answer, right? Because you had freight, which is fuel, and oil, which is obviously crude, which is globally traded and a big problem right now, we know. But what if I'm like a dairy farmer, right? And I've got however many head of cattle a dairy farmer has, and I need grain, and I call you, I see all this volatility, and I call you and I say, Eric, I want to buy my whole load right now at today's price for the rest of the year. Could you do that for me?
In a normal market, that is not difficult at all. The futures markets, for example, that reference point is quoted all the way out as far as typically 2 years. Huh. But when you have this uncertainty, you know, you need to start to say, okay, I have to project what transportation costs are, what supply and demand are for multiple years. The way you deal with that is, as somebody who is going to offer to a dairy customer, for instance, is you have to widen the margin or widen the risk premium if you're going to provide them a certain price that they can lock in. And it's difficult because everybody needs to price that risk of change into their quotes.
You know, it's funny. We've talked on the program a couple of times since the war started about the cost of risk, the price of risk. And here it is sort of rubber meeting the road in the grain business.
It certainly is. I think, you know, the biggest change probably in the world supply and demand, and that's what ultimately sets prices, is that the Ukraine is a major exporter of corn, major exporter of wheat. And it so therefore, who is going to supply that grain if it's not available in the expected time frame? And I would say today's activity, we've seen the markets move down dramatically. We've seen crude come down. Seems to be that there's at least a feeling in the markets that the conflict may moderate. Certainly no guarantees, but that's what the market tends to signal today, and it's certainly welcome.
Let me break the fourth wall just a little bit. Before we actually turn on the tape decks, I asked you where you were, and you said you were in Charleston, South Carolina, for a meeting of the National Food and Grain Association, of which you used to be the chair. What's the scuttlebutt, to use an old Navy term, in the quarters there about sort of the short to medium future of your line of work?
Well, I think we're all trying to get our head around, will those shipments of grain, which is, again, Ukraine, that is the margin that we need to keep markets rational and functioning. And I think it's trying to sort out the scenarios there. I think we all play scenario games in our conversations. What if, what if, what if? And then, of course, the bigger question is, what do we do next year if this is a longer term drawn out? And that's a bigger problem.
Right. Well, we'll have you on again in a year. Eric Wilkie is the president of Arizona Grain out in Casa Grande, Arizona. Also a past chairman of the board of the National Grain and Feed Association. Mr. Wilkie, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today. I don't do this a whole lot because, you know, once we run a story, we've run that story. But given the inflation moment in this economy right now, we are dragging two interviews out of the archives because they seem kind of relevant. The first one from 10, maybe 12 years ago with Jimmy Carter, who was the president the last time inflation started to get this high. On the topic of Paul Volcker, if I could just back up for a second.
Yeah, please.
You put him in the job. Yes. You, in essence, made this deal with him where he would do what he had to do and you would suffer the political consequences, according to your telling of it. And yet, it seems to me that he is most remembered and the president he is most associated with is Ronald Reagan for breaking the back of inflation. Does that gall you at all?
Not gall me, but you know, I recognize
bug you a little bit?
Well, you know, I was the one that suffered politically, and Ronald Reagan was the one that benefited from the Paul Volcker economic philosophy. But I don't begrudge the fact that it happened during the next term. I thought the next term was going to be mine.
I always did kind of love that line. Anyway, funny at the time, I suppose. A couple of years after that, Paul Volcker wrote a book. I talked to former President Carter a couple of years ago, and I asked him about you and him appointing you to this job. And here's what he said. Let's play that tape.
That was really, though, one of the most hotly debated things I did, because a lot of my political advisors said, don't appoint Paul Volcker because he's going to tighten up on everything and you will have no control at all over the Fed anymore.
That's pretty much it, right? I mean, you went in there, and if I read the recounting of that job interview correctly in this book, you basically said, I want independence and I got to do what I got to do.
Well, it was obvious why he wanted to see me, but I said, Mr. President, if you're thinking of appointing me chairman of the Federal Reserve, you have to know that I believe in a somewhat tighter monetary policy than we have been following and that my predecessor followed.
Yeah, you know, the next question I asked the president, actually, was, did you mind when he raised interest rates like that? And he said, oh, no, I thought it was going to be good for the next presidential term. I just thought that term was going to be mine, not Reagan.
No, I asked him once, did I cost him the election? And some people said, and he had kind of a wry smile, and he said, well, I think there were a few other factors as well.
Yeah, maybe a couple other things. Paul Volcker and Jimmy Carter there from the archives. All right, we got to go. No time for a moment of economic context today. Too much me talking, I suppose. Although this whole show has been economic context, right? Come on. Anyway, our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.